My name is Malusi Ndlovu, and I'll be chairing the session. Welcome to this Retirement Matters session titled In-Fund Living Annuities, Issues to Consider When Retirement Funds Implement In-Fund Annuity Strategies and the Experience and Learnings to Date. That's the abbreviated title. Hopefully you are in the right venue. If you are looking for a different session, please take the time now to leave. But you are welcome to stay. The session today will be presented by David Gluckman and Danny Van Zyl. Can I encourage you to please tweet and participate on social media? The hashtag is #ESSA2018. And please tag the Actuarial Society's account, at ActuarialSA. David is an executive committee with is an executive committee member with Sanlam Employee Benefits. He is a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa, and he is a member of the Actuarial Society's Retirement Matters Committee, the Surplus and Social Security Committee, as well as the ASISA Retirement Fund Disclosure Committee. Danny is also works at Sanlam in the employee benefits space. He is a member of the Institutional Investment Committee as well as the expert panel on the benchmark survey. He's also a fellow of the Actuarial Society and a CFP professional. So without further ado, please welcome David. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Melusi, and good morning, everybody. The genesis of this presentation, actually I can date that, was on the afternoon of the 5th of April this year, when I was under no idea I'd be presenting to the Actuarial Society this year, but an email arrived in my inbox saying the call for papers and presentations closes tomorrow. And they gave a list of possible subjects. One of them was in-fund living annuities, and I thought, well, I got collared into doing a presentation to the South African Independent Financial Advisors Association last year on the matter, so surely it won't be too difficult to update the presentation, and yeah, we are today, but it actually has been a lot of work over the subsequent 6 months, and I hope the presentation will be of value. That's the aim. So to set the scene, I mean, there's been a lot of talk and action, in fact, over the last 10 years on the retirement fund reform issues, but I would say it's concentrated more on the contributory phase. If I were to make a prediction, I will say that over the next 5 years, the focus is going to change to the deaccumulation phase, because obviously there's no point having a great retirement benefit at retirement age and then spending it poorly thereafter. And we can see that summarized in these national treasury concerns, where they talk about the contributory phase, and then essentially, I mean, we can debate if they're right or not right, but essentially the view that there are two worlds, and then members are simply, or retirees are left to the retail market, and now they want to get trustees or funds involved to actually try and get a better deal for the retirees ultimately. And I mean, obviously we all know it's now gone forward, and we've got the default regulations pretty much close to implementation in maybe a little bit over 100 days. And I mean, there we get a quote from a leading industry expert on the annuities market saying there are many trustees seriously considering in-fund options. And we'll get these sub-headlines, which I'll just chuck in there, because just to show that this is relevant, this is the Business Times less than 2 weeks ago. So the debate certainly is hotting up. And one reason why I do think it's important is, given in this slide, so this is our Sanlam benchmark research, and we surveyed over 500 members of retirement funds across the country in 2015. And we asked them the question, if your employer basically offered a good pension from your fund, would you take that? And with a 47.7% take-up, that actually means potentially this is a significant issue for the annuities market. I must say, you always have to wonder about these surveys. Do the members understand what they were being asked, etc.? But nonetheless, I think there is something in there. Turning to the industry statistics, I mean, over the last 15 years or so, I mean, we see this huge move towards living in yurties, which is maybe part of the reason we wanted to talk to that today. And if we summarize another way of looking at these statistics, we can see at the top the new business statistics for 2015. These are all annuities or retail annuities sold in South Africa. And maybe the interesting numbers, looking at numbers, living annuities outnumbering, let's say, conventional guaranteed life annuities, whatever you want to call them. I think we're using the term life annuities on a 4-to-1 basis, but in assets by 10-to-1. Maybe it's worthwhile just to contrast with some of the figures we're going to show later for income living annuities, that the average is about R1 million per new policy written. And in fact, that's pretty much also the case if you look at the whole book, over 400 billion in living annuities, about R1 million average according to the ASISA statistics. So, of course, you use averages with caution. The aim of our research is really just to inform the debates. I mean, the bottom line is you can like them or don't like them, but living annuities are the de facto pension of choice of South Africans. So that surely is an important thing. The default regulation specifically mentioned both in-fund and out-of-fund living annuities, and that really was the aim of our research. We said, let's try to contrast those two types of living annuities. We're not going to focus on other aspects like comparing life annuities to living annuities or talking about, you know, how you transition a living annuity to a guaranteed annuity over time, but we will touch on those briefly. But the main point is to talk about in-fund living annuities. So this, I think, is an interesting slide. And in fact, when I did my presentation last year, I only had 4 points of the differences between in-fund living annuities and out-of-fund living annuities, but we have extended it to 10 this year because, as Donnie and I have done the research, every now and again we come across a little subtle thing and we say, oh, that's another difference that we didn't think of. So let me try to run through them quite quickly. The first one, obviously, I won't go into great detail. The one's governed by the Pension Fund Act or subject to the Pension Fund Act, the other one subject to the Long-Term Insurance Act. The one is governed by a board of trustees. The other one, essentially, the contract is an individual insurance contract. Then we've got the differences in death benefits, nominated beneficiaries versus the 37C of the Pension Fund Act. Differences as far as Regulation 28 is concerned, as far as investments. And for out-of-fund annuities, I added the word yet, because Regulation 28 certainly does not currently apply to out-of-fund living annuities, but it does apply if any of those are going to be used as part of a trustee-endorsed strategy from March next year. And then the ones I didn't think about last year, but now kind of add them into the pot. Regulation 39, the default regulation, specifically for in-fund, the trustees have an obligation to monitor sustainability. And while that is not explicit in the case of out-of-fund living annuities when used as part of the Regulation 39 annuity, I would argue you kind of have to do it anyway because there is a requirement in Regulation 39 to review the strategy on an annual basis. And how can one review properly if you don't look at the experience of your retirees? The issue of transferability, another difference. Here's another one. I mean, out of fund, it's an insurance contract, so almost all the insurers are members of ASISA. ASISA standards apply. ASISA standards do not apply to funds. So while it might be good practice, in the absence of legislation, there's a difference in cost disclosure standards. There's even differences in who can advise on these products. Certainly out-of-fund living annuities would fall into the retail pension benefits category. It's debatable for in-fund living annuities. The safest, if you were to ask me, is to be registered both for or licensed both for retail pension benefits and pension benefits. But there can be a debate about that one. And here's one I really like because I hate bureaucracy and paperwork. So I can tell you a big advantage of in-fund living annuities is the money's already in the fund. You don't have to go through all the FICA burden, etc. And then there's differences of protection from creditors. So I must say, I think there are quite a few subtle differences. Some are significant, some are not so significant, but I'm not sure everyone advising on these things, you know, thinks about all those differences. So that's my introductory summary. I'm now going to hand over to Donnie to take through some of the analysis that we did.
Thank you, David. Hello, everyone. So we did two sets of research. Firstly, we mined our own data. We're a big administrator. We have a number of funds that have in-fund living annuities, and that helps us getting nice quantitative data. You know, we know how much it costs to, you know, for the funds to have that, because we're charging that fee. On the other hand, we did a survey as well, an online survey. A lot of these, the online survey were external funds, and there we can ask more qualitative data, sort of what have you learned and what have you seen. And part of the reason is to obviously see what we can learn from these funds. Some of them have been running in-fund living annuities since the late 90s, so they have a bit of experience. But also, it seems that some consultants have some pretty preconceived ideas about in-fund living annuities. When we started talking about this, I engaged with a group of consultants, and they had this idea that it is more likely to have people with small pots of money have going for in-fund living annuity, and therefore their drawdowns might be quite high. Now, when I mentioned that to David, he was quite, you know, surprised by that kind of thing. So we thought, well, let's go and test our own data and see whether that is actually relevant. Now, I must just emphasize that in all cases, we don't have hundreds of funds running in-fund living annuity. So the sample size is quite small. But these are your larger type funds, and they've been running for a while, so we do think the results are quite credible. So you can see the small number of pensioners, but it's been increasing about 25% per annum, which is a big increase, but from a small base. And then the other thing that David highlighted, the CISA figure shows an average fund value of around $1 million. Our data shows about three times that, so about members within 3 million rand nearly 3 million rand on average. So yes, the CISA data will have guys who have multiple product living annuities, a small part of their total savings, but it does show that perhaps the preconceived notion that only guys with the small pots will go here and the guys with the big pots will go outside is perhaps not quite valid. The one thing I also want to emphasize is all the funds we found have more than $1 billion in assets under management. So you don't find smaller funds actually offering in-fund living annuities, and we'll touch on that a bit later. Then if you just look against our data versus CISA data, the average fund pension, once again, is not a lot small. It's not smaller than the CISA data. It's actually larger. And even our drawdown rates, weighted or unweighted, does seem a bit better in the CISA figures. Now, those are average figures. What we ideally would like to do is just look at the drawdown per age band. Unfortunately, CISA doesn't give an average drawdown per age band. They give an asset value per drawdown band per age band. So what I did is sort of worked out the weighted average. So that grayish bar you see there, this CISA average per age band will be somewhere in that gray bar. I didn't use this average figure. And then we took our average, that's a red dot. And as you can see, per age band, it's either below the CISA average or it's at the bottom end of the CISA range. So once again, the notion that perhaps guys will have small pots and have high drawdown rates doesn't seem to be borne out in practice. Then also, the other thing that we realized as we started engaging with consultants is there is a preconceived idea that there will be a certain saving when you go in fund living annuity, and most consultants have this idea that it will be a 1% saving. Now, I'm always wondering where people get these sort of figures from. Firstly, is a 1% saving, you know, really relevant? Well, if you start with a 5 million and you draw like a 5% drawdown, you're getting about just over 20,000 rand per month, you know, pension. A 1% of your 5 million, you can save about 4,000 extra a month. So it is material, but is this really realistic? Can you expect a 1% saving? So we dug a little further on our data. So we have our own Sanlam data, which is in-fund living annuities, and then two major list providers out there. And we first looked at administration fees. So yes, obviously, the in-fund living annuity is a bit cheaper than administration fee, and mostly because it piggybacks on the bulk or the economies of scale from the active members in the fund. Would a fund, if with only in-fund living annuities, be able to pay such a low admin fee? Probably not. But it's, you know, they're piggybacking on that. And I'm just contrasting that to the Treasury paper from 2012. Then we look at advice. Only for those members who do pay advice, it's slightly cheaper. But overall, if you add administration advice together, you do get a 50 bits saving. So if you want to get to the mythical 1% saving, you actually need to have a saving on the investment side as well. Now, this is very difficult to actually compare because different funds have different investment choices, they have different fee arrangements, and the same with list providers. But our feeling is if you're a large fund, you can negotiate lower fees, and you may well access these portfolios and get a 50 bps saving. It is unlikely that a smaller fund, though, will access that 50 bps saving, and therefore a smaller fund is less likely to get to this 1% saving compared to the outer fund living annuities. Now, the one thing, you know, we pick up, the in-fund living annuities do piggyback on the active members, but also there's a difference in servicing model. And as Darby mentioned a while back, the big problem is you cannot deliver a retail service and then ask an institutional or a wholesale price. And I think that's something that a lot of these funds are still grappling with, you know, going forward. And yes, you know, this slide is still accurate until the end of the month. Okay, so then we turn to the retirement survey. So we had an online survey. We approached different funds who have been running in-fund living annuities. As I said, majority of them are not administered by Sundam. And we had 45 questions only. And once again, we had 15 funds responding, about 22 respondents. So sometimes we had more than one respondent per fund. But it was interesting sometimes we did the consultant's view and, for instance, the principal officer view. And as I said, it's a small pool. But once again, these are your larger guys who haven't been running it for a while. And just to show that, when we analyzed the data, showed there was like two waves of funds. Those who have had in-fund living annuities for many, many years. In fact, some of them since the late 90s. Then for a few years, nobody introduced in-fund living annuities. And then since 2015, there's another wave that actually introduced in-fund living annuity. Once again, numbers are quite small, but also growing quite fast on an annual basis. And I'm trying to move my slides forward. There you go. Oh, sorry. So we didn't ask them, these people, so we gave a list of possible responses and asked them, when you introduced your in-fund living annuity, what were the main reasons? And then we sort of just looked at those with more than five responses. Now, it's interesting, you can group a lot of them together. The first two, which are the highest number of selections, are about costs. It's your admin cost, it's an investment cost. So clearly, the whole reason why people think of in-fund living annuities is about cost. The second two, you can also group together, and that's about the cost and quality of, you know, retail financial advice. Clearly, some trustees have concerns about these. And then the last one is, you know, continuing with your pre-retirement investment or seamless transfer. So it's with ease of just continuing with what you have been doing. So it's very clear there's like the three main aims coming through. And we ask, well, why do you think members are choosing this? Once again, predetermined, you know, we had a list of options. Cost savings are the number one choice as well. So to a large extent, this is driven by cost. Now, what we also found out is a lot of trustees didn't really appreciate all the additional governance they need to do when they actually introduce the in-fund living annuity. And especially there are risks that members face when they're in the decumulation phase that's different from when they're in the accumulation phase. And some of those are investments and drawdown rates. So we asked actually trustees, do you review investment options from these in-fund living annuities and the drawdown rates? And the, you know, results are pretty similar for both. But as soon as you start digging a bit deeper once again, it's like, would trustees actually intervene if, for instance, there's suboptimal investment choices or whether they have unsustainably high drawdown rates? You see a bit of a difference emerging. Trustees are far more comfortable to intervene when drawdown rates are high than when investment options are unsustainable. And we actually ask, have you intervened in the past? And you can see, once again, trustees have intervened where people have very high drawdown rates. But only one of the respondents actually said, yes, we have intervened where the investment option was different. So once again, trustees perhaps feel less able or less comfortable intervening about investment choices, but are quite comfortable telling a member, no, you can't withdraw 17.5%. A lot of funds also have a cap imposed on their drawdown rates. Either it's a flat cap or it's an age-related cap up to below the maximum of 17.5%. But the other, nearly half said, no, it's fine. You can go and draw as much as you want to, which is quite interesting. We also ask our funds, do you prefer that the fixed drawdown be reviewed, you know, at a fixed date when you can review the drawdown rates? And this sort of harks back to the DB days where trustees would have one date in a year where they communicate to all the pensioners. Trustees find it a lot more easier than trying to communicate to members, you know, throughout the years. Everyone have to review the drawdown rate once a year. It's far easier for trustees. And then we looked at investment portfolios. Now, a number of funds actually have a large number of investment portfolios. Now, remember, Reg 39 says, you know, if your default investment strategy, you need a maximum of four investment choices. Now, a large number of funds actually just said, if a member post-retirement, you can access all the investment options that members had available pre-retirement. So, you know, there's a range of options, and you just go ahead and you can pick from that. And then four of them have more than 10 choices. Now, half of the funds actually have a default investment choice, and where there's a default, is split half-half between a moderate balance fund and a smooth bonus type portfolio. Oops. And then we said, would you mind, do you have prefer that Regulation 28 does not apply to your in-fund living annuitants? And actually, the most respondents said no, they're actually quite happy for Regulation 28 to apply. I think it also just makes it easier if Regulation 28 applies to the accounts pre-retirement, you use the same portfolios after retirement, and they prefer using the same portfolios. So a couple of things we picked up on is the risk specific to infant living annuitants is obviously your sequence of return or your path dependency risk. If you have a big market crash just after retirement, your chances of having a successful retirement is quite low. I had experience of this a few years ago. I was on the radio, and the next day, a woman from the Free State tracked me down. And he has been retired for 4 years, and he's halved his retirement capital. You know, what now? And unfortunately, there is no good news you can tell a member in that sort of a situation. The other big concern we have is members who are recklessly conservative. We do see a lot of members with a large cash allocation. And if you're going to live for 20, 30 years, you want CPI-related increase every year, that's just way too conservative. Now, what we do to just show trustees and the impact of sequence return risk, and this should be intuitive for actuaries, but if you have an X amount, you know, and you have a sequence of returns, the top one there where you start with high returns, end of low returns, and you just take the sequence and turn it around, you have the negative returns early on and high returns later, and you don't put money in or out, it doesn't really matter what the sequence is. You end up in the same place because you know, multiply 1 plus you know, I the whole time. As soon as a situation where, for instance, you have an annuitant who is withdrawing 6% per annum from his portfolio and increasing that every year with inflation, it makes a massive difference whether you have the high returns up front or the negative returns up front. And you quite likely run out of money. So you, essentially, what I tell members is, you know, you're standing in a hole, and while you know in the hole, you continue digging it deeper because you're withdrawing income and you're selling cheap units. Now, there are various ways to try and address sequence risk. And what was interesting is we're seeing more and more funds actually paying attention to this and thinking about how they can tweak their strategy going forward. And so this is an example we've used in a couple of presentations. There are other methods of addressing it as well. But let's say you have a conservative portfolio. So think of a low equity balance fund. So that's the yellow line. You have aggressive equity portfolio, the green line. And then you have something in the middle. You put a quarter of your money, so five times your annual drawdown, if your drawdown is 5%, into a conservative or a protection portfolio. Let's say a smooth bonus portfolio in this case. And the other three quarters you put in an aggressive portfolio. Now, first I'm going to focus on you have 50,000 Rand, and we want to keep the incomes level in real terms. So as long as the line says level, your income increases with inflation. But unfortunately, at some point of time, you're going to hit the 17.5% cap and your incomes are going down, which is obviously not a good thing. So first, I'm going to focus on a negative return environment. So in our modeling, our fifth percentile for results. As expected, you know, your aggressive portfolio underperforms in a low return environment because it is very aggressively invested. So your income goes down quicker. The more conservative portfolio does a little bit better in a negative environment, so that's your yield line, so it does fairly a little bit better. But it's interesting, even though your middle portfolio, which has a combination of smooth bonus and aggressive, and you actually draw all your income from the smooth bonus portfolio, even though you have sort of a three-quarter allocation to the aggressive portfolio, your end result is far more closer to the conservative portfolio than an aggressive one. So you have sort of protection built in. Now you might ask, now, what happens in a median return environment? And I'll just show this once again. In a median return environment, obviously your conservative portfolio will lag. But once again, your aggressive portfolio and the combination of the different two portfolios are doing better. So even though you have a quarter of your money in a smooth bonus type portfolio. So what we're seeing is funds are more thinking about using combining different kind of portfolios in a solution. But I do realize there is not one single portfolio that can address both sequence of return risk and investing too conservatively. And to a certain extent, this is like taking your life stage solution and just running it through retirement into retirement and investing people differently depending on how long they have been retired. And so we are expecting to see a lot more innovation in this regard going forward. Then we ask funds also, do you facilitate life annuity or guaranteed annuity quotations? A lot of them do, mostly at retirement, but we're also seeing a lot more funds being interested in allowing people to phase into a guaranteed annuity at later stages, age 70, 75, and so. And I know there's some presentations on this later in the conference. The one thing we like emphasizing to trustees, which I don't think is intuitively obvious, is with the flexibility of annuitizing later, there is a potential cost. It makes intuitive sense to say, yes, I still want to invest my money when I'm 65 or 70, but how many of us actually want to still be doing this when you're 85? You know, you might not have the cognitive ability to do that. So it makes sense to say, I'll be in a living annuity for 5, 10 years and then move into guaranteed annuity. But just look at the following example. Let's say a gentleman who's 65, he's single, he comes to Sanlam with one million rand, and says, please give me a guaranteed annuity escalating at 5% per annum. I asked our annuity team, and they said, fine, they'll give him an annuity of just under 100,000 rand per annum. So every year, his income will increase to 5%, so after 5 years, he'll get 121,000 per annum. Now, let's assume the same member decided, hang on, I'm not taking a living annuity, or should I guaranteed annuity. I'm investing in a living annuity, but I'm going to withdraw the same income as I would have received in a guaranteed annuity. So you can start with the same nearly 100,000 rand, increase it every year 5%. And then after 5 years, he's decided, now, hang on, I actually now, at this point in time, want to go and buy the guaranteed annuity that was quoted earlier. Now, the interesting thing is, if you buy an annuity later, you're now a select life. You know, when you've retired, there's a lot of people retiring with you who are in poor health. Most of them have passed away. Your likelihood of actually now making it to 80 is actually a bit higher. So, you know, relatively, you're paying a little bit more to actually buy the annuity at a later stage. So we would ask him about just over a million rand to get his now 121,000 per annum. And yes, this is a simplified example. I have the same yield curve. I'm assuming the mortality rate doesn't change, anything like that. And then the question is, what return does a member need in his living annuity for that period of time to break even, to be in the same position irrespective of whether he had the guaranteed annuity or living annuity? And the results are actually quite interesting. We showed that you need to earn about 14% per annum in nominal terms for that 5 years to just break even. Now, I hope like many of you will find that's quite a high percentage. After 15 years, you actually need 16% per annum to break even. Now, yes, flexibility sounds great. Often flexibility do come at a cost, and I don't think people really understand the impact, or trustees even understand the impact of that. And that's something we think that needs to be highlighted. Now, it has been pointed out to me that this is a very simplified example. You know, interest rates can go up, interest can go down, you know, the insurance company can change the pricing basis. And, you know, actuaries would have said, you know, we can time when we buy a guaranteed annuity when the interest rates spike. Well, the average fund member is not an actuary. He can't really decide on that. So, yes, it is nice to have flexibility. Just remember, on average, you are likely to pay a little bit more for having that flexibility. Then just turning to the default regulations. So a lot of these funds had these infant living annuities already before the default regs came out. We asked how many are going to use your current infant living annuity as your default annuity, and the majority said yes. What I found interesting is we did this survey in September. There's still four funds out of there that are unsure, and you have to have this ready by March next year, which is a bit of a concern. We also asked, would it be preferred annuity for the qualifying retirees? So you can have different default, you know, annuity strategies for different groups of members. Once again, the majority said yes, but once again, 6% of them say, well, they're not quite sure yet. Then we asked, what sort of changes do you anticipate, you know, in making your current infant living annuity, you know, your default annuity strategy? And these are things like they're going to reduce the number of investment options. Obviously, you can't have more than, you know, you can't have 10 or 15. You might review your drawdown caps. Once again, 7 of the funds said they're not sure. So I do expect there's a lot of work that's still going to be done January, February next year before funds actually have their default annuity strategies ready. Then just on the advice side, this is where I'm going to hand over to David. He actually has been involved with some default annuity options in his previous life as a valuator. And I think you can share some of these experiences. Thank you.
Okay, hello again. I want to start by giving an example of a fund that I worked with more than 20 years ago, which has shaped my thinking on the subject matter entirely. Is Professor Thompson in the audience? I don't think he is. No. Okay, but he was one of the people involved with this fund. So this is a fund, the University of the Witwatersrand Retirement Fund, and I was the consultant and for a while the evaluator in the mid-90s to early 2000s. And the interesting thing about, let's call it default or trustee-endorsed annuity strategies, these are topical at the moment because we have regulations coming from March next year, but there was nothing stopping trustees implementing such annuity strategies 20 years ago. They just didn't. But the University of the Witwatersrand Retirement Fund did, I think specifically because I mentioned Professor Thompson, but probably even more so Professor Anthony Asser was the chairman of the trustees. And basically, the way they structured this fund is that it's a provident fund, but they said that The benefit is a pension that you get from the fund unless you apply to the trustees to commute some or all of it. And if you you have to satisfy all the conditions of the trustees. And in order to satisfy those conditions, every retiree had to fill in a four-page document signed by their spouse if they were married, showing all the factors that they had considered and that they had taken advice and giving disclaimers, etc. So what you would think with all that is there would be quite a lot of pensioners would have ended up in the default strategy. That's kind of what I would assume, because you made it difficult. And the reason I know all this and is I was the person who used to do these. I was the person who used to write the letters to all the retirees, and I had my automated program to generate the standard letter. But no annuitant ever chose that option over almost a decade. And for me, that's interesting. Why was that the case? Why did no retiree ever take the default strategy, even though it was a well-structured strategy? And the most common response I get is must be commission-driven, you know, from advisors drove that decision, which I think might have been a slight issue, but I'm not so sure it was the predominant or the only issue. Maybe I just want to say at this stage, I'm always very careful about giving away client privilege information, but I regard this as 20 years later. I don't think it's particularly secret, and I think it's to the credit of that Board of Trustees anyway. So that makes me think that if you want a high take-up of people who are retiring, then surely you have to make it as simple as possible for those people and as seamless as possible for those people to take it up. So in my mind, these are the factors I list as important to take into account if you want any default strategy, because I think what follows from that or associated to that is if you don't have a high take-up, then all you've got is you've ticked a compliance box. You've got a theoretical solution, but no one goes in there. You haven't actually improved the outcomes of your retirees 1 cent. And Jaco van Tonde from Investec actually, he referred me to some research in the United States by a chap Michael Kitsis, which actually backs us up with research. Basically, they say if you give a retiring person long-term financial decision that they have to make at point of retirement, then the odds are they will not make that decision. They will defer it. And that, in my mind, explains why we, to a large extent, why we have such big take-up of living annuities in general in South Africa. So maybe to turn it around, I mean, Dani, you said that, if I can't remember exactly, but maybe trustees don't appreciate the downside of guaranteed annuities. Maybe I'll turn it around and say maybe actuaries or technicians don't appreciate the behavioural biases of individuals. But anyway, it points to this whole issue that we've got a retail world and an institutional world. As Treasury said in my opening slides, those have been separate worlds until now, but pretty much this is forcing them to collide. So we thought interesting to get some feedback. And on the one hand, this is from a financial advisor. It's Voter for E, very competent, very well-regarded financial advisor, but basically setting out the case why good financial advice is very important for a living annuitant, and I can't disagree with that at all. But on the other hand, actuaries and consultants and employee benefit specialists actually see things from through a different lens. So this is the feedback of an employee benefits consultant that I greatly respect. I won't mention the name, although it's that person's birthday today. I agree with all this feedback. You know, you've got to think about this from the situation of the person who will be sitting with the retiree and giving the advice. Do not underestimate that influence. And then going on to things like, you know, bringing in John Foster and don't fleece the members and all those type of things. So I think there are just two different worlds out there. That's what I'm trying to say. So going back to the survey that we asked, and yeah, I agree, Dani, with you, it's a small sample, but it's better than us just standing here and saying this is what we feel is the right answer. We asked the question, do you have a panel of advisors or credit advisors to advise on this in-fund living annuities? And we've actually, okay, that's a new acronym we've introduced, you'll have gathered in this presentation. And it's about a 50-50 split between funds who put in place some sort of panel advisor and those who don't. But it's no good, in my mind, just putting in a panel and no one remunerates them, because then nothing will be done by those advisors, I think, logically. So we asked the question, do you facilitate payment of advice fees? And again, it wasn't quite 50-50, but not far from it. So there are definitely two different schools of thoughts, I would say, among retirement fund trustees. And for those who said no, they don't even facilitate payment of the fee, we dug a bit further and said, how, you know, does the annuitant get advice on these products or guidance, etc.? And the one that Danny and I both agree is a problem is the six who said the member must just go find their own advice, because in practice, I think that just won't happen, actually. But maybe we can put that up for debate. And one reason it won't happen, now these are statistics that are not relevant to our kind of annuity research, but I think they're interesting in the sense they just illustrate the point. This is from exits from the Sanlam Umbrella Fund or retirements in 2016. What you will see is that there are only a small proportion of retirees who are of economic interest to financial advisors, simply not viable to advise below a certain level. Now, you may counter that people below that certain threshold shouldn't be buying living annuities in the first place, but I would argue, in a sense, that's an abdication from the trustees, because all that will happen is they will go into a retail living annuity anyway. So if your aim is to improve the retirement outcomes for members, you still have to consider the people, the retirees, with those lower amounts, because the research seems to indicate they will defer making any long-term binding financial commitments at point of retirement. So we then analysed our sample of 698 in-fund living annuitants. This is the Sanlam book again. And we looked at those where an advice fee is payable versus those where no advice fee is payable. And you'll see the vast majority, no advice fee is payable. I mean, we were trying to think of the question, are the advisors in some way adding value to justify? If you remember, there was a 44 basis points fee. And it does seem to be, in a sense, you could say justified by the differential in drawdown rates, but obviously this is an insignificant sample, so I don't think we want to draw any conclusions from this. We just put it out there, something maybe to research further in the future. So, to close, what are our learnings and recommendations? Because as Meluzi said, that was part of the abbreviated title. Before we give our learnings and recommendations, we actually ask the 22 surveyed principal officers, consultants, actuaries, trustees, what do they like about in-fund living annuities? And the way this question was phrased was different to all the previous questions that Danny showed. This was completely open-ended. It wasn't a multiple choice. You could answer any question, any answer you want to, and then we grouped the answers, and those that got more than five positives we've shown over here. And, yeah, it does seem to be that what the clients like with the benefit of hindsight is the cost effectiveness, they like the seamlessness, and they like the flexibility of living annuitants, to mention the top three. We also ask them what they dislike, and probably no surprises here, but it's monitoring burden, administration burden, and then the fear of the possible risks would be the top three as well, with some others chucked in there. We've got five as well. So maybe I like this quote. While I was doing the research, I had some interactions with Ant Lester of Willis Towers Watson, and he kind of summarized it in this one sentence, which is probably correct, one could say. There is, you know, it's this trade-off if you want to go in fund. There's the extra governance and monitoring, and maybe but if you do all that, you probably will get a better retirement outcome if you do it well in any event. So to start with, the first presentation I talked to last year, and remember I was talking to financial advisors, yeah, this is where I left it last year, to say, look, it does look like this is a viable option. It should be considered. I would say if you look at that 3 million average, what we would say is the initial client base is what we define or call the savvy, affluent retiree, not necessarily the average retiree. And you can read for yourself a few other issues I put up last year. Obviously, the one being product in infancy, we still have to see the long-term risks. If we move forward to this year, I stand by all those, but maybe add a few more that we thought in the course of our research. Firstly, what we also now seen, and it's with the default regulations coming to mind, we actually seen the emergence of out-of-fund, institutionally priced, you know, group-based out-of-fund living annuities. I mean, we didn't want to start analysing cost structures there because it's just, you know, you could say at this stage maybe marketing. When there's a body of data, we can analyse that data and see how it compares. But certainly it's worth analysing in future research. Obviously, moving towards the default regulations, I mean, it's clear a lot of the funds are still grappling. Some of the funds quite a few hadn't even started considering the issues when we surveyed them. So it'll be interesting to see what, you know, maybe in a year's time, what was the outcome, and no one at this stage knows it. I see Julia is in the audience there from the FSCA, and I know for sure they are working on what I understand will be a notice on maximum drawdown rate, sustainability and communication. By all means, correct or don't comment in the discussion. I haven't seen the content. I don't know what the content is. But I would say if it's half sensible, it's probably a good thing and probably make it even easier for trustees to monitor the things, because there will be a guideline to what they have to adhere. And I think what we would conclude is in-fund living annuities are a valid proposition. The main, you know, our research has borne out what kind of we knew intuitively, that the cost savings are the main driving factor, and that's the issue. You're always balancing cost savings with extra governance in deciding. I put a question: is it viable for funds of less than R1 billion to have these? I mean, as we would have seen, the 10 funds that we analysed all were more than R1 billion, and perhaps all the funds even in the survey, that the other 15 funds that we surveyed. I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. I think it really depends on the capability of that board of trustees. In a sense, it might even be linked more to not so much the size, but are you going to continue as a fund, or are you going to go the umbrella route? That might actually indicate this decision. So let me close with 7 recommendations that Danny and I make following our research. Now, these recommendations don't necessarily flow logically from what we've presented here today, but they are things we've discussed over the course of our research and we think would be a step in the right direction. Now, the one principal thing we say in the heading is it seems strange to us if you've got 2 similar type of products, why are there so many fundamental differences? So to us, a principal point is, unless there's a good reason for a difference, the reform direction should surely be to eliminate those differences. So we're very much in favour of strengthening competition. We believe that's going to add, you know, we like an environment where people can move their money around their retirees, let the best product win. So we're all in favour of consolidation of in-fund living annuities and out-of-fund living annuities. We're all in favour of transferability between these as well. The issue of 37C, we would say it's an unnecessary difference. We know there are quite advanced proposals, we understand, to only make 37C applicable while in service of the employer. So that actually might eliminate that difference in the not too distant future anyway, which probably would be a good thing. I think the CISA standard should be implemented for in-fund living annuities. It's much more important than member-level disclosure, which I know CISA are working on. And the reason it's much more important is it's a purchase decision. So I would say it should be, but CISA can't do it. It requires legislative change. I think it's clear to us that this is a new area for retirement fund trustees, and they really have to rethink the whole issue of advice and support to in-fund living annuities. And actually, I don't think it's just in-fund living annuities. Preservation, in a sense, will be that factor as well. The issue of an annual drawdown rate, much more like when you have an annual pension increase date for pensioners, guaranteed pensions paid from a fund, like in a defined benefit days, would certainly, in our mind, be an improvement and improve the governance of these structures. And finally, the phase categorizations need a rethink, and it shouldn't just, it's not just in-fund living annuities, it's preservation as well, because with the default regulations, we're likely to have many more preserved members in a fund. And in a sense, you could argue that no one is going to be able to advise on those people preserved in a fund, because if someone has got R1 million preserved in the fund and you want to speak to, an advisor wants to speak to them, say, I'm thinking of moving you from here to that retail product, I don't see how you can give comprehensive advice unless you can advise on both elements. But the licensing doesn't allow them. They've got to say, I can't tell you anything about your current fund. I can only tell you about where you're going, which is problematic. So we would say phase categorisation should be structured on skill sets rather than licensing, and they should be identical for in-fund living annuities and out-of-fund living annuities. So I hope that's been of some interest. I want to thank quite a few people who helped us with the work along the way, and hopefully we can have some good discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
you very much, David and Danny. I think this is absolutely timely. I know a lot of trustees, consultants, and organizations are grappling with implementing their annuity strategies ahead of Regulation 39 coming into effect. We've got some time for questions. So if you have a question, please put up your hand, and we will take... there's one back there.
Hi, Linda from Zimbabwe. We have one fund which on dollarization in 2009, which is 10 years ago, decided that drawdown together with converting to DC would be the answer for their annuitants. At that stage, and still there is virtually no legislation for us to comply with. We therefore have to apply actuarial techniques and principles as set by professional bodies to the best of our abilities and professional judgments. And we do quite a lot of reading and try and do the best we can to advise and help the annuitants to get the best out of what they've got. We have a lot of problems. So thank you very much. This has been amazing. And I totally sympathize with the problems that you have with this research. So this is really another area for which you might want to develop the research. It's also something that trustees might take. It's something that's developed over the last 10 years as technology has developed, and it's something I think we can take back as our communication with our legislator has improved, as our communication with our trustees has improved, as our communication with our trustees, as our trustees themselves has improved. I think one of the things that we can do with employees, our employees are now incredibly savvy. With no cash in the economy, there is no cash in Zimbabwe. Everything is done by electronic transfer of money, mostly by mobile phone. Very little internet banking. Most people don't have computers to do it on. It's done by mobile phone. So if we can get trustees to educate the 45, the 30-year-old as to what their choices will be at retirement, as far as drawdown goes.
Sorry to interrupt you, Linda. I'm going to ask that you wrap up and get to the question.
Thank you. But the question, the questions are for the next presentation. Can there be something on research into what education is done amongst companies in that pre-retirement sector and what trustees are doing? Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. I think that's something, it was more for a recommendation, so we'll certainly take it forward with the next convention. Are there any other questions? Okay, we've got a hand there at the back.
Thanks. There we go. I think there's one big other difference between an in-fund living annuity and buying one with the... Do you want to stand, David? You're stuck. there's one big other difference between buying one in a fund and buying one outside. The reality is retirement funds spend a lot of time with an investment consultant who consults on investments as his full-time job in a fund. Then you go out to an advisor, and the advisor spends most of his day trying to sell a product so he can earn commission. He doesn't spend 100% of his working day understanding the investment markets. So what he ends up doing is he ends up putting all of his members into a product he's heard about or some investment default, and all the ASISA research seems to suggest everyone goes into a balanced portfolio. So I don't think we should be underestimating the value of an investment consultant sitting with trustees deciding what an in-fund living annuity investment strategy should be versus a financial advisor who's trying to sell a product, earn commission, and then stops worrying about the investments.
Thanks. Do you want to respond to that, David, Danny?
Just to answer, I think I do agree. There is a difference between the advice you get on the institutional side and on the retail side, I would think. And this definitely is something, a valid point.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, we've got a hand here in the middle. Can I ask that you please just state your name and your company?
It's Julia from the FSCA. I think David kind of forced me to say something here. I just wanted to mention that the conduct standard relating to the default regulations for living annuities has actually already been drafted. It's just going through our internal review process before it gets issued. I was hoping it would already be issued, so actually people could already be discussing it, but I don't think it's going to be much longer, so probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Maybe I'll just add on that. Is Danny and I were well aware that we might have to make a change to our slides at the last minute if something got issued, but it didn't.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Okay, we've got a question from Michelle here in front.
I suppose not so much a question than a comment. The one thing that we haven't touched on around the challenges here is the administration difference in managing retirement funds up to retirement and what you need to administer moving from retirement to decumulation stage. And I think that's a big challenge because we're just assuming that it's a decision by the trustees and you can click your fingers and it will be implemented. But that's not necessarily practically what's going to happen. And I don't think there's been a huge amount of work around how do you practically manage in-fund living annuities and administration platform for administrators that maybe haven't done it before? So I think that's also a factor that probably needs to be added to consideration.
Look, that's, I'm not just saying the women are asking questions, so they clearly live longer. But that's obviously 100% correct. And, I mean, Darby de Villiers' comment talks to that about, you know, I mean, even for like speaking for someone who works for an administrator has done it, there's had to be significant learnings in getting to grips with the issue. So it's 100% valid. I mean, that's definitely something that's maybe a first question trustees would have to ask whoever is the current administrator, because probably it would be a big ask to move the administration on the basis of this decision alone.
Hi, Fadi Boyson of Mutual Wealth. Just a quick question on the caps that were spoken about on advice fees that are facilitated by the in-fund living annuities. Are those fees capped at a product advice level or at a financial planning fee level? In other words, does it make provision for comprehensive financial planning as well?
From our understanding from interaction with the clients, it's more on just the in-fund living annuity. So there will be a cap on normally as a percentage of assets on that. Whether a financial advisor can include, you know, holistic financial advice under that cap is perhaps doubtful. So I do think if the member wants more holistic advice, they probably need to pay outside the fund for that.
Yeah, maybe just to add on to that, look, I think that's correct. And this is part of where the industry is grappling with. And I think it will be the same for these institutional products out of fund living annuitants, because the trustees, in a sense, have now this obligation to control all the costs. And I think it's at a stage, I think the EB consultant I quoted, you know, refers to that kind of, the industry is now trying to grapple with where is that right middle ground. And no one actually knows the answer. What we will, you know, if it's set too low, then you will actually see that ultimately in your monitoring that no one's getting access to appropriate advice, and then boards would be forced to think about upping it. And I guess it's something we'll have to find the right middle ground over time. And maybe to go on further, I mean, the practices would differ from fund to fund to fund on that.
Thank you. We've got a question at the back there.
It's John Anderson from Alexander Forbes. So thanks for all the good insights. I think we've also done some analysis over the last 10 to 15 years, I think, looking at, you know, a broader database. And I think it's not just retirement, but also looking at preservation. I think I'll just share some of that because I think it is relevant here. Just trying to analyze what are the key success factors to improve the outcomes for individuals, improving their pensions. I think that's ultimately what we want to do. By just having a solution, something that you put on the table in place already improves. And I think there's, that's proven. The other thing is that advice is important. So when you don't put advice in place, or at least support, so that could be member education, retirement benefits counseling, or formal advice, definitely improves the outcome. I think I've also had some experience with funds that put things in place, there was no advice, and exactly the same experience as the WITS fund. So I think it is the solution, advice. An interesting one is that industry is a key factor determining success. And what that really means is that you can't have a one-size-fits-all. So different industries require different approaches depending on the member demographic. So structuring it around that. And the last factor is experience. Now, I think, unfortunately, there is no science behind that. But just in looking at in practice, when you make it, as you say, David, easy for members to get onboarded, look at what they're doing, get the options, it makes it take all those things away, the compliance, the paperwork, etc. So I think, and then also working with the human resources and how they promote these things in the workforce. So I guess my question, that was comment, question is, how do you see the next level is that engagement part, whether it's in or out of fund, doesn't matter. The engagement part, how do you see that evolving? Because I think that's the next thing to enhance outcomes. Thank you.
John, I mean, I absolutely agree with everything you said there. I could summarize it as one has to think about this puzzle holistically, and a lot of the parts of the puzzle have been thought of in isolation in the past, and it's not just the quantitative side, we have to think about the human behavioral side, the education side. So I think it'll be a big, you know, the issue of a new, never mind in fund living initiatives, so the issue of how boards of trustees get involved in this post-retirement space is going to be an interesting one, and I think a lot of people historically in the employee benefits industry and a lot of people historically more in the retail advice space are going to learn a lot, and probably the annuity space I think will look very different in 5 years' time. But what that will actually be, I can't say at this stage.
I think just to add to that, so we're very excited about all the developments on the member counselling side. So we do think it's quite important for members to start thinking about retirement, you know, a couple of years before you actually hit it. Unfortunately, you know, retirement is not something you build up a lot of experience in. You only retire once. You can't redo it again in 5 or 10 years' time if you mess it up the first time. So having perhaps the functionality to let people test drive a different annuity option or something like that before retirement will go a long way in giving a bit more comfort and assist members.
Yeah, thanks for that, John. And I think you're absolutely right. So, I mean, this is a very complex issue, and there's no doubt that it's about putting all the right pieces together. David did allude to the fact that it's about creating a seamless experience from pre to post-retirement. And I think that statement is quite innocent sounding, but there's a lot to how you actually create that seamless experience, because that makes all the difference. Are we going to have any other questions? Okay, we've got a question right up front here.
Following on
John's
question.
Get a mic here, please.
Thanks. It's Mickey Lowther. Following on from John's point, I've seen some interpretations that the regulation doesn't actually require a product. It merely requires a strategy. And that almost makes sense from what John has said, that it's the engagement is actually gets more points than the product. Is it your understanding that one actually needs a product in the default annuity strategy?
Look, I'm aware of that interpretation, and I'm actually not sure. I've thought about it. I'm actually not sure of the answer. I think that those are the type of things that would be, we'll find out in time to come. But having said that, I actually think it's even better if you have a product in any event, or a solution. I think if this just remains a theoretical concept that trustees put up, this is theoretically what we're likely to do, and we've seen lots of that even before default regulations, then very few retirees will go into it. So to me, a big part of the puzzle, and I tried to make that case earlier, is if the aim is to improve the retirement outcomes, you must have a high take-up rate. And if, the only way to have a high take-up rate is you've got to make it tangible. And you need, you know, so I actually think you need a solution, or I would recommend it. Yeah.
Thanks. We've got time for about one or two other questions.
Thank you. Neil Harris from PwC. I think I'm going to keep this fairly brief because I'm aware we might be running out of time. And I'm talking less as a pensions actuary, but more as a trustee on our own staff retirement fund and our own experience. So one of the biggest hurdles faced by retirement funds, and especially when it comes to the in-fund strategies, is the lack of ability to consolidate all the retirement savings in one place. That's a big reason why I think many funds are going out of fund, looking at retail product. And our board, and I think there might be other board of trustees out there as well, see their role more in the sense of bringing the critical mass, that bulk buying power ability to negotiate better deals for the members than what they would be able to get in the retail market. And I think it maybe even speaks to a bigger, I don't want to call it a problem, but a bigger hurdle that we're facing in the industry, because even for active members, they're faced with the same thing. As a trustee, individual members have got a lot of savings outside of the funds as well. They might have with a previous fund, retirement annuities, preservation funds, and what the case may be, and they can't consolidate that in one place. So as a trustee, we can do projection statements and all kinds of nice communication, but at the end of the day, we've got a very limited view of what that individual, what his position is. So I guess the challenge would be to have a think about how we can, what we need to do in the industry to be closer aligned, what kind of framework we need to put in place to start consolidating all the information and really getting a more holistic view of the individual's position, and then what role pensions actuaries and trustees can play in that space.
Okay. Maybe I'll look at all valid comments, and actually I'm a member elected trustee of our staff fund, so I have the same issues. I guess PwC may not be the average profile client out there fund. One could argue, but I think the point you make about consolidation and fragmentation is very valid, and you would have seen that right at the top of our 7 recommendations. So in a sense, if the regulator, what I would argue, wants to make this optimal, I would argue strongly that the issue of transferability and consolidation is the best way to go from a reform perspective. And, you know, I believe in those free market principles, and then with full, you know, disclosure, transparency, good advice, all those issues, and then the best product provider will win, and that surely is a good thing.
Thank you very much. I think we are out of time. I just want to thank Danny and David, and encourage that you please participate in social platforms using the hashtag ASA 2018. Thank you very much.